Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. I'm Scott Hoag with my co-host Tom Coffeen. Ed Horley is out today. Today, we're going to talk about thinking differently with IPv6 with our guest, Chris Grundemann, VP of Client Success for Myriad 360, a network and IT engineering professional services shop. We've known Chris for a number of years through the Rocky Mountain IPv6 Task Force, his work writing articles and the day one Juniper books on IPv6. So welcome, Chris, to our show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So we'd like to jump right in and start to ask you some questions around IPv6. So, you know, given this late date of 2020 and the year it's shaping up to be, what's your take on IPv6 status? Any thoughts you have about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think definitely it's been a long journey for myself, and I know there's many other who have kind of been on this train for even longer. I think I did my first training, or a deep dive anyway, into IPv6 routing back in 2011. So that's been 9 years ago. In between now and then, obviously, we've had a couple of IPv6 days, different, you know, IPv6 day and IPv6 launch. And a bunch of work around the industry to kind of help raise awareness of IPv6 and get folks in there. And I think, you know, one of the things that struck me probably, I guess, midway through my own journey with IPv6 was just this kind of difference between, you know, folks who are really deep technologists and are just doing things because either one, it's a cool new thing to do, or it's an exciting thing to work on, or because they see the value for kind of the greater good of the whole internet. And that was obviously, you know, the very early adopters of IPv6. When I first started dabbling in it, you know, that 10 years ago and ish. And then we started hitting kind of a little bit of a wall where to get adoption much beyond that, you know, most businesses, surprise, surprise, need some kind of reason to deploy IPv6 beyond just the fact that it might be the best thing for the internet long-term. They actually need to justify the spend, you know, internally. And obviously, you know, you all were with me there. You know, we've talked a long time about, you know, preparing yourself for that migration, buying gear, you know, now. And we were saying this again, you know, 6, 7, 8 years ago, buy gear now to ensure that you're able to turn it on when you need to. And I think we're finally into that space where that's really happening, right? So beyond the, you know, those early adopters of folks who knew it was the right thing to do and knew it was the future way ahead of time, then you kind of came into the folks who are running really large networks. Right. So the really big, you know, telcos or cable providers or cloud scale, web scale companies that had to deploy IPv6 because they were hitting constraints of the IPv4 numbers. And now we're finally, I think, starting to see that happen in a little more of the, you know, down market of the smaller cloud providers, smaller SaaS operators, smaller ISPs or NSPs, and even into the enterprise space, which I think is where, you know, you'll start to see this adoption kind of start to hockey stick as folks really hit that need for V6 and then really understand that they have to reach customers who are going to be on IPv6 only connections or who are at least on native IPv6 connections. And so, you know, I won't be as silly as to call 2020 the year of IPv6. We are definitely, you know, pretty far along in this journey and really starting to see some interesting things happen where more and more folks are aware, I think, of IPv6 and the need for it and are actually taking that into their network design plans, even in, you know, kind of just typical IT shops versus, you know, folks who are really engaged in the ITF and really understand the technology, which is the case 10 years ago.
Chris, it makes me wonder, you know, the whole idea that the three of us and certainly Ed, who's not here today, but just there's a number of other engineers. Scott mentioned the Rocky Mountain V6 Task Force. I mean, obviously, we've been focused on IPv6 as a critical network technology for a pretty long time. And I was going to ask, you know, what advice you would give novice engineers when it comes to what they do or don't need to know. But I thought maybe a more kind of interesting question might be, you know, what you see the state of engineers that are coming up today. Because I'm always wondering, you know, when we're going to cross that threshold of where IPv6 is just, you know, just part of the suite of technologies that engineers are deploying and using, and they're not thinking about it as something that they have to, you know, adopt or very specifically deploy. It's just something that's part of the fabric of the overall technologies that they're leveraging to solve network problems. So do you see that? Do you think we've reached that point? And if not, what do you think it'll take to get there?
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that is a good way to look at it. I don't think we're quite there yet. I do think there's some signs of that happening. I believe that, you know, as far as kind of tackling that second part of that question first, right, which is what will it take to get there? I think a big thing is some of the, you know, just attrition or rewriting of the textbooks and certifications and other ways where folks learn the networking trade. And what I mean is, you know, as long as we're using IPv4 kind of throughout all of that stuff pervasively, then IPv6 is something you learn later, right? And I remember, you know, back in the very beginnings of my career when I first started like looking into certification tests and things, IPv6 was there. It was kind of, you know, an appendix maybe at the back. It was an add-on. And, you know, I was literally told by people, oh, don't worry about that. Like, that's not a really big deal. It's not a real thing. And then years and years later, kind of realized like how important it was and how much it came into be. And that's definitely not quite the case anymore, right? IPv6 is not just annex at the back of the study guide, but I don't think it's the, you know, uniform example for IP addresses in all the textbooks either.
Right.
And I think when we see that happen, that's when we'll really see folks just come out and kind of be IPv6 by default and then learn the IPv4 legacy technology. But of course, you know, I think the training also has to mirror reality, which is, you know, we're definitely, you know, still in a heavily V4 world, in a heavily dual stacked world in the best case, and then not approaching that, you know, V6 only state for quite a while still. And so I think it'll be learning both, right? But again, I still think, you know, when you see the examples in the learning text switch, that's when we'll really be there, where that'll be the default and we'll be in a lot better place.
Yeah, you definitely see if you look at job boards and you just search for IPv6, there's lots of jobs that mention IPv6 as one of the required, you know, knowledge areas. I wonder how many, when you get to the interview, how many questions actually get asked about, you know, the solicited node multicast group address or anything like that.
Write one on the whiteboard.
But yeah, I mean, it's definitely on there as part of the requisite knowledge required for certain positions, right?
Sure, I think so. And I think you're right. I think it would be interesting. I wonder if we could do some kind of secret shopper or secret interviewer program. Find out if they're actually asking about that, or if it's really required. It's just one of those HR things about the form.
We've secretly substituted IPv6 for IPv4. Let's see if candidate A notices the difference.
And I do think, you know, the awareness is so much higher, right? I mean, if we're talking in terms of, you know, a decade ago to now, I think the vast majority of folks I speak to, no matter where they work, at least know about IPv6, even very junior engineers, right? Know about it, understand it, which is a big shift. There's been a sea change over the last 10 years, for sure. Whether or not they're actually deploying it day to day, that's a big question mark. And I do think that, you know, one place where, at least in my mind, we're going to see V6 really start to shine. And especially if you're, you know, a brand new network engineer, if you're just getting into the space and you're learning some things, you know, the space that fascinates me the most is working in containers and those kind of things, where you're ending up with, you know, lots and lots of microservices, plus potentially sidecars and different things like that. And then building out service mesh. And I don't see any way, there's no way I would tackle a problem like that without using IPv6. And the scale I have of addressing there to be able to understand and work with that. So I think that's an area where those two things are going to be complementary, especially for new folks working on new things. I think that'll be an accelerant.
And I think there, you know, people who are interested in IPv6 are also interested in new things. And someone who's interested in IPv6 would be interested in keeping their skills up, learning, you know, newer technologies, keeping their career, you know, relevant. And so you work with a lot of customers that are pretty and have pretty sophisticated network deployments, high level of complexity. What is a common thread among these deployments operationally? In other words, like, which technology deployments in the last few years have been most impactful to those customers? And then how does knowing IPv6 make you think differently about building solutions for those customers with these new technology sets you just mentioned?
Yeah, that's really interesting. So at Myriad 360 specifically, we kind of segment our customers into two general camps. One we call the cloud builders. And really the way I define that is that's customers who we're selling them gear or setting up services for them that in turn they are going to use to serve their customers. And then on the other side, the enterprise side is folks who the gear we're selling to them, the services we're performing for them, is specifically for their internal IT and for their employees versus their customers. And so that's kind of the split. Obviously, you can land in both. It's a fuzzy line, but those are kind of the two things. And I think on the, you know, on the cloud builder side, that's definitely where we've seen the biggest uptake of IPv6 so far, and then where it's had the largest impact. And again, a lot of that scale, but also a lot of that is, you know, future-proofing and ensuring that that everybody's ready and that you have those, you know, ability. I mean, because one thing, if you're writing an application today, I think you really need to be understanding that, you know, a chunk of your users are actually on V6 connections, right? A lot of mobile phones or work on IPv6 only and get translated at the edge of that network. And you're going to start to see parts of the world that are IPv6 only. And we've been talking about that for a long time, but I think it's very real today. And so being able to test on IPv6, even if you're in a part of the world or a part of the economy that doesn't necessarily have those challenges, you need to be able to test it. And so we're seeing on the cloud builder side, especially for infrastructure as a service type companies, they have to have IPv6 there. Their customers are demanding it. Yeah. So that's been big for them. Mm-hmm. On the enterprise side, like I said, it's still a little bit slower. It depends, right? There's some companies, a lot of them are, you know, some of the folks that are, you know, would maybe be called cloud native or kind of really pushing the envelope on kind of the constant improvement, constant development, DevOps type cycle, where they're really doing some interesting things with automation and getting back to just using Linux as kind of a base for all things. That's another place where I think I've seen IPv6 be really more paramount and more forefront. Kind of to your point, Scott, about, you know, folks who are into IPv6 are also into other new things, and that does seem to kind of go together.
Yeah, because cloud implies, you know, broad network reachability or internet reachability, mm-hmm. and you want, you know, it to be reachable from all of your customers using V4 or V6 and give them the best opportunity to connect to you and your website, your web app, regardless of which protocol is being used.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And so I think, you know, going down that path a little further, one thing, I don't know if it's exactly what you were asking, but just as far as a deployment that I've seen that really kind of was interesting to me, you know, I won't talk about the name of the company, but there was an Israeli startup that was basically doing what they're calling software-defined perimeter, which is essentially, you know, an always-on VPN that's kind of really geared towards zero-trust network access and zero-trust architecture. And the way they did it, though, on the back end, I was fascinated to find out, was by using IPv6. And so what they essentially did is, because of the breadth of V6 that's available, they were able to essentially carve out a subnet for every user. And then what they do is they just put multiple addresses on all the services so that you're literally on the network with the services you have access to. And any services you don't have access to are not on your network. You have no IP reachability to them. And so it made, you know, kind of took micro-segmentation to the next level, where instead of, you know, blocking through filtering or ACLs or policy or whatever, what have you, you're literally on your own network with your own services. Mm. And I thought that was really, really interesting. And so I think those are one of those things, you know, getting to that last part of the question about how does knowing IPv6 make you think differently about building solutions for customers? That was definitely the biggest thing for me, was that shift from, you know, thinking about how many hosts are going to be on this network with that IPv4 mindset of kind of subnet planning, to how many networks do I need in this architecture, which was more of the IPv6 view. And that shift, which sounds really simple in those two sentences, but it's actually a pretty massive change in how you think about things. Mm-hmm. And moving into that space of looking at, you know, one of the guys who used to work for me, Jan Zors, Slovenia, really smart guy. He always used to joke, you know, how many hosts are in 1/64? And the answer is all of them. Or how many hosts can you fit in 1/64?
Yeah, all of them.
And the answer is all of them, right? Because we don't have enough hosts to fill up a 1/64 on the planet yet. And so when you start thinking in that terms, right, of just, okay, we don't care about the addresses. There's enough of them, definitely. How many networks do you need? That shift and the things you can do when you start engineering networks based on that different, whole different methodology is pretty interesting.
Totally agree with that, Chris. And it kind of shifts the question a little bit. Maybe it gives us like sort of a different metric to apply that question of, you know, how do we know when IPv6 has arrived? Because there's just sort of this, you know, the grinding it out and getting it deployed, and okay, it's happened for service provider, and okay, now it's happening for enterprise at maybe a slower rate, or obviously a slower rate. We're getting there. We're grinding it out. But then the secondary development of, you know, when it's ubiquitous enough that people really do start using it to solve interesting and challenging problems based on what the protocol can do, and especially what we just talked about, the, you know, the address, the massive address space, that taking advantage of that is just like one element of it. But maybe that's another metric for, you know, when IPv6 has arrived, when you start to see these solutions that come out where people are leveraging what's available to do. And I you know, so like you mentioned the container space. I mean, that's certainly where from the very beginning, it seemed pretty intuitive that the automation and container space and data center provisioning would benefit greatly from what IPv6 offered. And then just, you know, it was kind of like a hurry up and wait scenario where it's like, okay, we have to wait for, you know, a lot of these projects to actually reach a kind of maturity where they recognize this opportunity with IPv6. And I feel like maybe we're closer today than we have been. But yeah, maybe that's another way to look at whether or not we can really consider IPv6 having arrived or having matured.
Yeah, I think that's a great yardstick, actually. I think, and totally orthogonal, but I think related. I recently read a really good article, very timely, about, you know, the move for a lot of folks to remote work and we're working remotely because of the current situation we're in. And it kind of had this almost like a Maslow's hierarchy, but of remote work, where kind of the base level was, you know, just everybody's able to be remote. And you just basically forklift over what you were doing in the office to being remote. And there were several steps, and I forget all of them, but kind of it ended up getting to the point where at the top, you're actually using this idea of being remote and having asynchronous communication and not scheduling necessarily all the, you know, a bunch of Zoom meetings, but instead using things like chat platforms and things to speak asynchronously and write out decisions in long form so that other people can look at them. And just this kind of whole transformation of actually, you know, not just doing what you were doing before in a new format, but actually using the new format to create new opportunity. And I see that in what you're saying with IPv6. And I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, step one is just getting basic network functionality that we were seeing from IPv4 and IPv6. Step two, when it's really arrived, as you said, I believe you're right, that's when we'll see some really kind of game-changing or mind-bending solutions that couldn't have been conceived of in an IPv4 world.
And those are the ones that, you know, there's a fair amount of paranoia about people who are familiar with IPv6. That's when we're going to use up all the IPv6 addresses. Somebody's going to come up with the application that uses up all the IPv6 addresses.
Yeah, because what Chris was describing reminds me of RFC 8273, which is unique IPv6 prefix per host.
Per host, yeah.
So can you give an entire host a /64 in and of itself, you know, to do what Chris described, micro segment in and of that, so that host can only talk to itself, but it has plentiful number of addresses to run all the containers, run all the services inside of itself in an isolated zero trust network. Yeah, kind of micro segment there. There's other kind of crazy ideas out there about how we can use IPv6 addresses. You know, every connection use a different interface identifier or use the interface, overload the interface identifier with some other meaning or something like that. Not just, you know, stable Slack or privacy address, but do other things in that space to do something meaningful or unique or creative.
Yeah, definitely. And I always laugh a little bit at the fears of running out of addresses. I mean, I had that initial reaction too, and I think that's a really good sign of having not fully wrapped your head around IPv6 yet,
exactly.
Which is totally fair. I think everybody goes through that phase. Yeah. And to get myself over it, I wrote a blog post, man, I think back in 2009 now. I'll have to dig it up and put it in the show notes if anybody wants to kind of do some nerding out on math of this. And the best comparison I came up with was comparing IPv4/30s to IPv6/64s. Basically say, okay, these are the smallest subnetworks you can use for various reasons. And if you look at that, right, there is about a billion possible IPv4/30s. And of course, that's not counting, you know, stuff that's reserved and everything else, but just out of the space possible, there's about a billion. And an IPv6/64s, it's like 1.8 times 10 to the 19th, which means there's roughly 17 billion times more IPv6 than IPv4, even when you're looking at it from that network point of view.
Just
once. Right?
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. Yeah, the I remember seeing Jeff Doyle talking about IPv6 at the V6 Task Force in Texas, and it's one of the analogies that he used for consumption, one of the metrics he was sort of using to see where consumption is going to lead us in terms of what it would take to really, you know, bring IPv6 down to the level where we'd have to think about that kind of that problem of running out. And it was like he was looking at the time, this was probably 4 or 5 years ago, but he was looking at the rate of /48 consumption, which of course, you know, it's meaningless if you're trying to measure the amount of IPv6 being consumed by looking at individual host addresses, that's a meaningless metric. And then of course, 64s, that's a probably a meaningless metric. But I think that, you know, the rears pay attention to like how quickly 48s are going out the door, the collection of 48s and larger subnets are going out the door. And he was using that as sort of like gaming out where we would be in another 80 years. And he arrived at, 80 years in the future, like the estimate is 15 billion population on Earth, because I'm not sure how we're going to pull that off. But at the current rate of IPv6 consumption of slash 48s, by the year 2100, with 15 billion people on the planet, there would still be enough slash 48s to give everyone on the planet 2200 slash 48s. And on top of that, that was only out of the existing global unicast allocation. The existing 12.5% of the addresses are, away the IID, you know, throw away the 64 bits, it's still only 25% of the available IPv6 space. So yeah, that was kind of when the scales fell from my eyes, where I was just like, all right, this is just silly to worry about.
Yeah, definitely. And then I think that plays a little bit back, kind of, Scott, to where you're going, which is kind of these future uses and stuff. And definitely one of the things that I'm still kind of in the back of my head expecting to happen, or you know, is this kind of personal area network, right? As we get see more and more wearables and different things like that, I just have a feeling that that's going to be something that's needed, where we all become kind of walking networks. And it's already happening to an extent, right? My phone's always connected to a couple of Bluetooth things, but moving that all to IP might be the future there. I don't know.
It's the PAN, but without the NAT, or without the PAT.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So given your long experience with it, what would you change about IPv6 or how it's deployed or how people approach it?
I don't know. I think, you know, I wasn't there in those early days in the ITF when it was getting hammered out. And I wouldn't presume to think that I, you know more or more experienced than those folks, even though I am starting to get a little bit of gray in my beard. But I mean, there's definitely some issues that we've worked out in production, so to speak. You know, one, which I don't know is actually surmountable or not. There's been some blustering here and there about it, but not from anybody I know is super credible, but just the whole idea of backwards compatibility. Obviously, that would have been great, right? That may be a magic wand request, but you know, when you're looking at, I really like the diagram of kind of the hourglass, and understanding that, you know, IP, the internet protocol, is that stem between, you know, basically, you know, any kind of, you know, MAC-PHY layer stuff and any higher level protocol or down stuff. That, you know, the unifying thing that makes a network is that internet protocol in that stem of the hourglass there. And obviously transitioning to a different protocol that ships in the night that doesn't really see the other one, you know, we had to know this was gonna be a tough transition. Now whether you could have done anything else different about that, I don't know, but that's definitely one thing if I could have changed, would have been great, right? To have that backwards compatibility somehow. I don't know if it's actually possible or not.
It's more like an hourglass, but with two holes that go from the top to the bottom rather than just one bigger hole with V4 and V6 in the one hole, because they are ships in the night. They're two separate paths to go from the top piece of sand to the lower chamber.
Yeah, which is another thing I think that's, you know, aside from the scale of IPv6 address space, just that understanding that you're literally running two networks, I think is another big thing of understanding IPv6, in that, you know, you're not adding IPv6 to your IPv4 network. You're really running a new network, at least at that logical layer, which is, I think, an interesting point and something that you have to get behind. Beyond that, I think, you know, the extension headers have been problematic more than they were worth. I really liked the idea, right, of an extensible protocol. That's a fascinating idea, and I get why that was done. But in practice, I think, as we've seen, you know, almost all of the standard extension headers ended up being pretty major security flaws. The idea of extension headers in general opened up kind of a Pandora's box of security problems, to the point that, you know, many folks who deployed IPv6 early on just started blocking almost every extension header out of the gate, which made them pretty useless. So even though it was kind of a beautiful idea from an engineering perspective, the practice didn't turn out that way. So that's another thing, you know, maybe just, I don't know if there's another way to make a protocol extensible. To me, you know, I definitely can't think of one. And the extensibility is a cool idea. Either not doing that from the beginning, or finding a better way to address the security concerns, or something around, you know, figuring out extension headers a little bit better would have been another thing.
Yeah, it'd be cool. You know, you come up with your own unique way of handling packets that maybe get forked or merged or copied or something. And you call it the CRISP protocol, and you go to the Internet Assigned Number Authority, you get your own little extension header, you know, protocol identifier, but you'd have to get everyone else in the world to not block your CRISP header to allow your cool new whiz-bang way of communicating to function across the internet.
But to your point, Scott, I mean, that's actually interesting, right? Because if you look at, you know, one of the other things that I've worked on a lot in these past, you know, same kind of 11 years or maybe a little less, is on the SDN side, right? And seeing, you know, OpenFlow come out and then a lot of other stuff since then. And now we're seeing, you know, things like the P4 programming language with programmable chipsets. We can actually program the pipeline in software instead of having that hardware set. But those are, again, those are kind of things that are really, really cool in your own network, right? Inside of your data center, inside of your campus, or between the two of them, you can do some really interesting things. But obviously, you know, no service provider is going to give you OpenFlow API access to their routers to do stuff with your packets going across the internet. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's a similar thing with IPv6 extension headers, right? Maybe we're looking at it in a different scope. And what we really should be looking at it is, you know, the internal scale where inside of my, if I have a massive enterprise or a big cloud builder, I can do a lot of really cool things with extension headers. I just can't necessarily get my neighbors or my peers to do them with me.
Yeah, it's an age-old problem, right? I mean, the technology, when they're thinking of the tech, how to improve the technology, and there's a way of creating something that could be used as a security application or a security extension or something to improve the extensibility of the protocol. These are like technical solutions that fall somewhere in, like, you know, layer 1 through 7 of the OSI model. But then it's, you know, when you get into the things like the failure of interdomain multicast to ever really manifest and all the promise that sort of held, like think of all the cool whizzy things you could do if interdomain multicast was like a thing. And if it could be deployed. But the reality is that it all exists outside the domain of the technical challenges. They're all business challenges. They're all political challenges, you know, getting networks to interoperate and what those interoperations look like and how they have to be handled from a political and a business economic standpoint. And so you feel really, like, as a technologist, you're like, this is so cool. It'd be great if we could all just get on the same page and use it. But it's so difficult to make happen because of those other challenges that aren't really related to the technology itself.
Yeah, it reminds me when I was really hot and heavy in the ITF, there was a group IT professionals from some big enterprises that were coming and had issues with IPv6 because IPv6 moves away from doing fragmentation, which means there's no sequence number in the header. And these folks were using that sequence number field to put a unique identifier on packets to make sure that packets were being received across their own network. Mm-hmm. And because that field was taken out of the header, they were freaking out and saying, we can't use IPv6, we can't move to IPv6 because, you know, you don't have this feature, which was really interesting because they were using something completely for a different purpose than what it was intended for anyway. And then seeing it gone away, they were trying to, you know, add this feature back into IPv6. It was a really interesting story there, but I think kind of a corollary of that, right? Which is just these kind of unintended consequences of the way folks use technology and what technology actually does.
Yeah, that's right. And since we're getting a little philosophical, like, you know, one of the things I found interesting, so we're all sort of swimming in the same waters around IPv6 over the years, and Chris, you've published some interesting things over the years, but you've always, as a technologist, you've always sort of cast a wider net in terms of the impact of technology and on society, and the culture at large. And I'm kind of wondering, if you have the view that technology is something that can be used to lead to the betterment of humankind, in that context, what do you think the technologist's role or job is going to look like in like 10 or 20 years, or, you know, even just like the lowly quote unquote network engineer? Like how do those jobs change based on, you know, where technology might take us in improving society and culture at large?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's definitely philosophical. I think that I do think about that quite a bit. And I do believe that technology will lead to the betterment of humankind and has and is. I really like Kevin Kelly's approach to the idea. He wrote a book called The Technium. And if you don't want to read the whole book, he's got a really good TED Talk up about it. If you look for Kevin Kelly, you'll find it probably. And what he talks about is this idea that technology has kind of co-evolved with humanity for a long time. And he really looks at, you know, technology as this like ape family of life on the planet. a little bit tongue in cheek, but if you look at it, it actually kind of makes sense and then works. And it's really interesting. And I think that that's happened. I think that we have kind of co-evolved with technology, and I think we're going to continue to. One of the things that, that seems to happen is the continued abstraction of that technology. And so, you know, if you look back, I mean, not that long ago, you know, using the US as an example, not that, you know, maybe what, a couple hundred years ago, people were, you know, going across the United States with, you know, horses and carriages, and were responsible to find or grow their own food. They built their own houses with their own hands. You know, if anything went wrong, any, you know, almost any medical care of their family or their children, or even their, you know, animals and livestock was all taken care of themselves. And, you know, fast forward, you know, to now, and we've abstracted almost all of that away from ourselves. Mm-hmm. And most of us, you know, find meat in a plastic wrapper, or even vegetables, right, in a plastic wrapper in the grocery store. And we take our cars to a mechanic, and on and on. And I think that trend is happening kind of in the IT space now. And it's a really interesting trend, I think. One of the things that that I've noticed really readily is transition of what infrastructure means to technologists. You know, when I started out, it was, you know, a physical server you would pick up and put into a rack, and then a physical router. And these things were kind of the technology infrastructure. And you actually plug things together and cable them up. And obviously, there's still that's still out there and exists. But a lot of folks, newer engineers, to them, infrastructure is a VM or a container and a VLAN, mm-hmm. and, you know, a virtual router, and there are these things they can play with in software. And what's interesting is that there's definitely still somebody racking a server and plugging it into a router. And so you've just got these like abstractions and layers. And I think that's what's going to happen to the industry and kind of the jobs and the roles as well, is we'll see this kind of increased specialization and stratification of where you work within that stack, which is interesting, right? Because a lot of the talk lately has been about this idea of a full stack engineer, which I think is less and less a real thing, actually, not more and more.
Yeah.
Where you've got folks who are working at these different layers of the abstraction. And so like a layer cake, right? With folks working at different layers, all super important and all kind of interrelated, but becoming a little bit less visible to each other, actually, through these abstractions.
So Chris, you're always working on some interesting projects. I know security's always been an interest of yours, you know, in the past and also recently. So what are some of the projects you're working on? What are some topics that have interest for you, you find challenging, or things you're actively doing these days?
Yeah, well, we've talked about a lot of it, actually. You know, one of the big things, obviously, my focus still remains on building, you know, networks that are bigger and more scalable and easier to operate. And that really works through both automation and telemetry. I spend a lot of time talking to clients and other folks about both visibility and control. And that's in networks as well as security and other things. But, you know, we're really seeing some changes in the networking space particularly, but in infrastructure, technology infrastructure in general, around getting more and more automation and better automation, and also better telemetry and better ways to pull visibility and do visualization and that kind of thing. And, you know, those two things are then coming together where we're starting to see, you know, the glimmerings at least of the idea of closed loop automation and self-healing networks and things along those lines. So that's a really interesting area for sure. And then definitely cybersecurity as well. I think cybersecurity is something that's interestingly similar to IPv6 as far as key stakeholders finally paying attention to it more and more recently. And on the security side, obviously, you know, greater regulations and more intense and more frequent cybercrime, and even state actors getting involved and having that spill over into the private space has definitely raised the awareness quite a bit over the last few years of cybersecurity. And so that's definitely driven my ability to kind of be involved and be more into it as well. So those are kind of really the two key areas. I like to talk a lot about the idea of a cloud integrated network, which is essentially connectivity everywhere you operate. And also a secure and mobile workforce, which is really all about allowing your employees and partners and customers to work wherever they are securely. And so you combine those two things, and I think that's kind of a distributed, secure, automated future that I see around the corner. If I was trying to be Wayne Gretzky and skate to where the puck was going to be, that's where I'm heading.
That's super cool. It's always great to hear things you're thinking about and things you're working on. Well, unlike IPv6, we've run out of space for this podcast, thanks to today's guest, Chris Grundemann. So Chris, tell the audience how they can follow you on the internet, things you're working on, articles, books, public appearances, your Twitter handle. How can our audience follow you?
Sure. Yeah, usually I'd have a couple conference talks lined up, but this year it's a little strange, so you have to find me online. You can find me on Twitter, at Chris Grundemann, or also I have a personal website that's chrisgrundemann.com. So either one of those, you can usually find what I'm doing and what's going on pretty easily. And also myriad360.com is the company I work for, and we do a lot of consulting and integration work in the technology space. So we'd love to help you out if you have questions or need something on that front as well.
Yeah, definitely. Reach out to Chris if you think he can help you. You can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast on Twitter at IPv6Buzz. You can also hit up each of us on Twitter. Tom is at IPv6Tom. I'm at Scott Hoag, H-O-double-G. And Ed is at E. Horley, E-H-O-R-L-E-Y. And thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes or Spotify. That really helps. If you like this podcast, we'd recommend you check out Heavy Networking or Day 2 Cloud or Network Break podcasts. There's so much great technical content over at Packet Pushers at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.